Right, we're all here. We've recorded some silence. It's time to record the Linux Voice podcast, Series 4, Episode 2. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I'm Graham Morrison.
And I'm Mike Saunders.
And in today's Fun Pants audio emission, we've got news. We've got a special piece of news. We've got a halfway reminder, Finds of the Fortnight. We may or may not have some neurons to look at. Mike's holding up his thumb.
Thumbs up from Germany.
But it looks like there's going to be success there, which is fantastic. We also have a Voice of the Masses, which for brevity is going to be really short. If you like the sound of that, but in a more regular paper-based form, we also do a magazine cunningly called Linux Voice, which you can buy from shop.linuxvoice.com or in several news agents, all the good news agents, not the rubbish news agents, around the world, from sea to shining sea, from Vancouver to Hong Kong.
And there's a new issue out today. Issue 24 is out today in the UK.
Ah, synergy.
Our 24th issue, that's 2 years.
Right, should we crack on with the regular news?
Before
we get to the special news.
Yeah, not that this news is anything other than lovely. But
no, in fact, the first item, most of the items are very lovely. Some of them aren't. But we'll start with a lovely item. The Qt company has changed the license for the software to make it even more free. So this is the sort of graphics toolkit behind KDE and LXQt and possibly some of the desktop environments and gubbinses. It wasn't originally free, then they sort of, but it was free as in beer, but not as in speech. Then they changed it so it was kind of free as in speech.
Oh, you mean right in the very beginning, right in the very beginning of the early
days. Like years ago. Then it changed to become more free, and now it's even freer now. So previously it was free, so it was released under the GPL for Linux and Android. Now that includes Windows, OS X, and iOS, so it's all the platforms basically. Almost all the platforms. And they've also, all their enterprise stuff, they've just released as open source as well. So that includes things like enterprise tooling and 3D visualizations and such like. And some of their Qt Quick stuff is free software now as well.
Mike, it sounds like Ben just dissed your platform.
Me? What? Who? Did Ben mention macOS?
No, exactly. He didn't mention macOS.
Oh, I see.
That's the whole point. He did mention macOS, and yet it's available for all the platforms. Come on.
Yeah. He said, like, all real platforms. I'll let that one slip by.
It's available for all platforms capable of connecting to the internet.
Capable of getting viruses, you mean?
Okay, so this is a good thing, isn't it? This is more cross-platform development. This is Qt being a more attractive desktop toolkit for developers and free software winning, right?
Yeah, it should make it easier for Qt software to be ported across more platforms. And
I think it's also a profound change in the way that Qt has been run, and also a great signal that its current owner, Digya, mean to embrace the free software open source community. Something that, as great as Qt is, and I've been a huge fan of Qt ever since I got into Linux, it was actually the Qt API that got me writing KDE applications. It's always kind of very tentatively adopted open source. It was basically what led to GTK and GNOME in the beginning, because the original licenses weren't open source. And while they have always done the right thing, there was, you know, we've had the GPL and the LGPL versions, it was always cautious steps, even with Trolltech and then with Nokia. And what really worried me with Nokia was that many of the new enterprise technologies that they've now opened were developed as closed source tools for their enterprise customers. So things like the QML profiler, which were brilliant, you couldn't be used by people who are actually doing the Qt Quick stuff or the QML stuff as open source developers. And so this is a shift in attitude, I think, for the people behind Qt, and showing that the project really does mean to ally itself with open source and free software, which is, you know, almost the first time in probably the almost 20 years that Qt has been around, which is good.
Yeah, it's one of those things that so many of us in the Linux world just associate it as the KDE toolkit, but that's actually not really what it is at all. It's a huge cross-platform toolkit for all sorts of enterprise things, really. And it just happens to be used for KDE as well. But that's not really its raison d'etre.
No, I think Matthias Ettrick chose Qt because it basically did loads of stuff for you, things like string management and file handling. And also, of course, it had lots of UI stuff that you could just integrate into your applications without worrying too much about it, which is same now. And the cross-platform development stuff is really good. Qt Creator, the IDE, is really good. The fact that you can create Android and OS 10 apps and iOS apps is really good. All open source.
Excellent.
Yeah. Really good for the future, I think. That's the, you know, there's always some uncertainty about the future of KDE investing so much effort into working with Qt. And I think this just means it's absolutely, and there won't be a fork. There won't need to be a fork. Qt will remain open and be principally open source.
Okay, let's move on with our second item of Linux news this fortnight. Google Chrome is dropping support for, I've written down here, 32 gigabyte distros, but I mean 32-bit distros. So this means that, well, it means exactly what it says on the tin. It means that older machines won't be able to run the commercial version of Google Chrome. They'll still be able to run the open source Chromium builds. For now, at least, I've got, obviously, if Google put in stuff that no longer compiles on 32-bit, then Chromium will have to make a decision there.
What are the biggest differences between Chromium and Chrome?
Well, it's a whole load of stuff that sort of sits in the back. Well, things like Flash getting bundled with it and sort of linking into Google stuff. You know, basically whether or not all your data gets sent to Google.
Mm. Yeah, if you watch a YouTube video when you're logged into to Gmail in Chrome, it'll remember it and then send it to your phone or your telly the next time you want to watch something. It's weird.
It's the future.
The future's weird. I don't like it.
I think Google must know how many people are using 32-bit builds of its browser, and they must have decided that it's an insignificantly small number.
Yeah, and to be honest, that doesn't surprise me, because if you're running a 32-bit machine, you may well be running a lower power browser, because Chrome is pretty RAM hungry and can be quite CPU hungry as well. So it may well be that if you're running a 32-bit OS, you're actually better off with a lighter weight browser.
If anybody is looking for a lightweight browser that's not based on Gecko or Blink or then look in LinuxWise issue 24, because I did a group test on them, like Dillo and NetSurf and stuff like that.
Do you still use Elinx as your browser of choice, Mike?
My favourite text mode web browser is now W3M.
Oh, yeah.
It's really, really good. It's got a better sort of layout engine, I think, if you can call it that in text mode.
It's still a layout engine, and it's, to be honest, it's probably a much harder engine to get right than a graphical one.
Well, yeah, really, yeah. Especially when you've got like multiple divs floating around the place.
Okay, let's move on to other organisations dropping things. The Linux Foundation have dropped individual members, so it is now only open to corporations with deep pockets. As an individual, you can still join as a supporter, which doesn't mean a huge amount, really. But we'll get onto this in a bit more detail in our Voice of the Masses later on. So for now, we should just leave that there.
Hold fire on the Linux Foundation.
Yes, that feeling built up inside of you that you want to shout out, rein it in for a little while.
It's difficult.
Let's move on to some more open sourcing news. Microsoft, that benefactor of open source software and friend of the community, has open sourced their Chakra JavaScript engine. This is the sort of the meat behind their Edge browser. It's now open source and available to anyone who wants it, and including the Node.js project. And this is it's basically a server-side bit of software running on a JavaScript engine, which is really good for event-driven programming. And it's previously been built on the JavaScript engine from Chrome. And now
V8, is it?
Yes, it still runs with V8, but you can now run it with Chakra, should you wish, particularly if you're deploying stuff to Microsoft platforms.
Do we know which specific open source license Microsoft's using. I wonder how permissive it is or how friendly it is to the wider free software community.
It's the BPL, the Balmer Public License. Load up Chakra.
Hang on, I'll just quickly load up Chakra.
Use W3M.
But I hate Edge when I've used it. What are Microsoft doing?
What? Why? I've never used it. Why is it so bad?
It just looks weird. It's got the whole kind of Windows 7, 8 Metro thing going on that's no longer called Metro.
I've never been... Well, I always have to be reminded where to type URLs in. It just doesn't look like a browser should look.
The Chakra is now available on the available under the MIT public license.
Okay, that's pretty permissive then. Yes. All projects can use it then. Okay.
That's good.
MIT as in MIT.
Yes. Yeah, that's pretty much a do whatever you want with it license. And including putting it in closed source software. Sticking on browser news, Brendan Eich has launched a new browser called Brave. He's done quite well to get the brave.com domain name for this. That's the most impressive thing I've seen about this browser.
Maybe he's always had it and just been wondering what to do with it.
And the sort of selling point behind this browser, really, it seems a bit odd to me, right? You go to a website, it strips out all the ads for that website. But then it puts back in other ads, which they call clean ads, which I don't know. So basically...
That's brave.
It just changes the... Yeah, that's brave. It changes the ads around on the website for some unspecified clean ads, which presumably Brave get a cut off. They claim that they give some of the money back to the content creators originally as sort of recompense for ripping out their ads and not allowing them to manage their own advert inventory. And it also allows you to pay a donation that Brave get to set what it is instead of viewing ads. And I'm sort of torn on this a little bit because on the one hand, ads can be incredibly annoying. But on the other hand, should an ad web browser really be swapping ads around?
It is a bit funny, yeah. Related to this was recently the Forbes website.
Oh, that was terrible.
People.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was blocking people who were using ad blockers. So if you went to one of their sites, it said, hey, we see that you're using uBlock or AdBlock, you know, please disable it. And this caused a lot of hoo-ha amongst people. And then it turned out that Forbes was then serving up malware adverts. So Ben, you just said adverts can be annoying, and that's true. I don't even mind annoying adverts. I just won't go to the site again if they're really annoying. I think the system should work like that. But Forbes was serving up adverts that said, your Java installation is out of date. Click here to download this .exe file. That's malware. That's bad.
Yeah.
Yeah, but what makes us think Brave are going to be any better? Forbes didn't know they were serving up malware.
Yeah, Forbes buy their adverts from some advert providing company.
So to get around Forbes' check on AdBlock, I had to run NoScript. And that's the situation that these people are running, creating for themselves.
Don't go to Forbes.
Well, yeah, but there was a couple of interesting stories on there last week. And I mean, interesting.
Which you wanted to read for free without paying for them.
Well, I would have lived with them or live without them. This is the problem that they have. Nobody, you know, nobody invited them onto the internet and said they could make money out of it. I mean, it's a huge problem. I mean, just yesterday there was a report on the UK newspaper The Times has a paywall, effectively. It's one of Rupert Murdoch's newspapers, and it's breaking even. It's lost a significant chunk of its readership, but it still has 200,000 people paying for content on iPads, which is a complete contrast to The Guardian, for example, which has made its biggest losses in its history, reportedly, over the last 12 months. And that has a very open policy on publishing content online that then goes into the next paper. So it's a problem. I haven't got a solution for it. You know, we're content creators. We're trying our best to trying to do things our way, but there is no easy answer. I don't think the answer is, malware and just more ads.
But even that, the Guardian comparison, if you add in the Daily Mail is free, And they're making heaps of money.
Yeah, and that's true. I mean, I think the number of views on The Guardian has gone up from 2 million to 7 or 8 million.
Wow.
So in terms of its global audience, it's much bigger. And the Mail Online, as you say, is like one of the biggest sites on the internet, which I guess is how they make money.
And don't The Guardian give you the option to pay and not see ads?
They do, yeah. You can become a supporter.
Yeah, but evidently no one wants to do that.
I know, it's difficult. I mean, I read quite a bit of The Guardian's content and I don't pay either, which is bad. It's just the path of least resistance to content, I think. I'm sorry, I don't have an answer. I'm just reiterating there's a huge problem. None of these are the solutions.
Yeah, I looked into another way of ad blocking the other day. David Cameron has mandated that all web service providers, internet service providers, have to allow you to filter out adult content and filter out what someone decides as adult content and all that sort of thing. And I was like, well, I don't really want that, but there is a load of stuff I would like to filter out, including adverts and tracking, basically. So I was like, oh, maybe I can use my internet services provider's filter to do this for me. So it's all running off. I've used Sky. I've got this called the Sky Home Router, I think. And the first thing I discovered is on the admin page to that, there's no cross-site request forgery checks, which is pretty bad. It means you can really easily just inject rules into people's routers from a website with essentially no security. But it was quite handy for this. It allowed me to write a JavaScript function that would just fire in a load of domains to block. But what transpires is, David Cameron's come out and said, you've got to block all adult contents. It can't block HTTPS sites. So this has very little to do with ad blocking, really. It's just how appallingly lax one of the UK's largest ISPs is when it comes to implementing filters. And considering this is the domain hub, all domain searches go through it as well, it could quite easily block HTTPS sites. There's no technical reason stopping it. That's just something I discovered this week.
You're breaking all the rules.
Yeah.
Discoveries in the news section. What are the next?
Yeah, but like you, Graham, I do find it an awkward position because adverts can be incredibly annoying, but not paying for them just means we get rubbish content on the web. Yeah.
And I really don't think I've consciously ever bought a single thing as a response to an advert I've seen on the web.
Not consciously, though. But subconsciously, you don't know.
No, but I just don't buy anything.
And there's all the ads that you don't really realise are ads, like the top results in Google search queries.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, exposure and people knowing about you, of course, is very important.
I think a lot of the time the ad companies are not very clever either. Like, I was looking at printers and then I bought a printer and then I was still getting adverts for printers. It's like, well, no, serve me something related to printers. Don't just keep printer adverts. I've already bought one. I'm not going to keep buying one every week. It's not
printer ink and paper and toner.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
And there's also, I don't know if you use Facebook, but there's pretty much every post you see on that is an advert that's not just someone's status update. I mean, we post Linux Voice stuff on it, but hardly anyone sees it, despite the fact that we've got quite a lot of likes and quite a lot of people share it, because we don't pay Facebook to spam everyone with it. So even if you've liked a page, you probably won't see their posts unless they decide to pay for it. Such is the glory of social media.
Well, that turned into a rant about the web and ads.
Should we finish on some happy news?
Yes, please.
This isn't so much a new news story as an update as to what from last podcast. And this is AMD's GPU Open project to make loads of their stuff available for under open licenses and generally help open source developers. Well, it launched today as we record this, or yesterday as you're listening to this. You can go to gpuopen.com/welcometogpuopen and read all about the openness. That concludes the regular news for this fortnight.
Regular news. That implies that there's some irregular news, some extra special news.
Indeed, there is some irregular... It's so good, I've lost the ability to speak. So, irregular extra special news this fortnight is we, Linux Voice, are launching a book, specifically a children's book aimed to introduce the ideas behind computing, but not a computing book. It's an adventure book about pirates and robots. And as you read it, or as your child reads it, they'll start to understand the concepts of computing, how the principles behind computing, how programming works. And it also works in the idea of the robot that's going along through the adventure is a robot, not some magical sci-fi imagining of a robot, but an actual robot that needs to be programmed to be told how to do stuff that doesn't have some magical artificial intelligence that doesn't exist.
Help me, R2-D2.
Exactly.
Syntax error.
Exactly. We're launching this as a Kickstarter campaign. So if you like the idea of this and you have children or you know of children that would benefit from learning about computing, then head to our Kickstarter campaign. You can get to it through beepbeepyar.com. That's the name of the book. Beep, as in B-E-E-P, the sound a robot makes, and yarr, as in Y-A-R-R, the sound a pirate makes.
Awesome logic. I understand.
If you know any children who could benefit from learning about computing, that kind of is a fairly widely cast net, isn't it? That's pretty much all children.
All children, yeah, absolutely.
So there's basically 3 billion of them in the world. The chances are you know one or two. Get them a book. It'll be awesome. Head to our linuxvoice.com for more details. You won't be able to miss all the various adverts on the site unless you're running Adblock. And that concludes our extra special news this fortnight.
Awesome. It's now time for Finds of the Fortnight. And it's actually been, I think it's been 3 weeks because we really spent a few days trying to finalise our plans for the book. As usual, I asked our IRC channel, so I'll start with them. There's been a few finds. Andy Ballum said he's found Elm, which is actually a programming language for creating dynamic websites, but it's using functional techniques rather than procedural. So he says it's brilliant fun and a really good community. Still Void says, similar to Mike, actually, he said, my find is that it's possible to buy a home printer that A, works splendidly with Linux, and B, doesn't cost a fortune for ink, and C, isn't ridiculously expensive. He doesn't actually, it's a Samsung laser printer, £60 with Wi-Fi, and it's really good.
I highly recommend a laser printer as well, rather than inkjet for home printing.
I've got one as well. I think it was like €60 here. I'm amazed how cheap they are now.
Are they carcinogenic if you have them in your bedroom?
I'll soon find out. Tell you in 10 years.
I think I remember reading about this. I worry because for a long time, for years, I had a LaserJet 2. I kind of inherited it from an old job that I took with me wherever I went. This thing was the size
Hang on. You inherited it from an old job?
Yeah.
you stole it from the office.
No, you can't steal these things. It's the size of a small car. But I used to use it all the time. I had a PostScript cartridge for it. It was brilliant. It lasted for like a decade. But I had it in my bedroom. So I'm like, I mean, those old HP laser jets, if anything was carcinogenic, those things were the smell of ozone when you did the printing. For those times when you don't have YouTube DL available to you, there's www.clipconverter.cc. That sounds great. That's from Devilman. I was hoping people might be interested in a tool I made to clean up the /boot directory for people who install lots of kernels. That sounds like a great idea. He's included the link, syslinux-editor on GitHub, but I'll put the link into the podcast notes. It allows you to select and delete kernel images and init ramfs in /boot and clean up the syslinux.config file. That sounds excellent. HegX64 provides a link to the encyclopedia.wikia.com, which has some really funny jokes. He links to a couple of jokes. That's true. It's been a while since that came up in the office, but we used to have some fun with that. McPhail, if you have a USB keyboard which is incorrectly registered as a joystick due to long-standing kernel stupidity, says it can interfere with the function of games controllers. There's a UDEV joystick blacklist link that sets up a UDEV rule to sort that out. That sounds useful. And his second find is Ubuntu-support status command. It's useful to know if you have packages which are no longer being supported, updated by Canonical on your Ubuntu installation. That sounds really handy too. I didn't know about that.
Yeah, that first find from the ISE channel, when you said Elm, I was thinking of that email.
Me too, yeah, yeah.
1980s, I thought that's a find for someone. That's even in development.
Yeah, I think it might be, you know. I looked at Elm recently and doing some FOSS picks.
It could be, but I thought recently, you know, as in 1995, yeah. Everybody had moved over Pine. To Pine, because yeah. Pine is not Elm. Oh, that's...
Is that what Pine means?
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Pine is Elm. Pico is the Pine composer. And I don't know what Nano stands for. It might have some sort of a...
I always assumed Pico and Nano were sort of related.
Well, yeah, Nano is
small
is a,
things.
Yeah, Nano is a GNU free software version of Pico with a boatload of extra features on top as well.
Yeah, being slightly less small than Pico, presumably.
And yeah, as well. Okay, I'll go through mine quickly while I'm here. Brian Masney said he sent me a find because he's been doing the assembly tutorials in the magazine and came across Boot to Sol, which is solitaire in a bootloader. So that's the game of solitaire in 512 bytes, or actually 510 bytes because 2 bytes are the signature. It's quite impressive what you can do in that amount of size. You know, we always talk about Elite and what Brabham and Co. did in 22K, but what you can do in 510 bytes is awesome. And my second...
What version of Solitaire? There's like 100 games all called Solitaire.
No, like the card game.
The card game, not the one with the marbles.
No, sorry. Yeah, I should have made that clear. Yeah, it's the card game. Yeah, like you'd get with good old Windows.
Oh, yeah.
Although I believe you have to pay for it in Windows 10, but anyway.
If you want to get rid of the adverts.
Yeah. And my second find was, I was watching some SpaceX videos, as you do. SpaceX being the company that wants to put people on Mars in 10 years. But it's also launching satellites and being awesome. And they had this video of showing stage separation testing, so where... different parts of the rocket as they go into space separate so they can get higher and higher. And it showed stage one and stage two separating. And you look closely, and I've put an image up online that we'll link to in the notes. If you look closely at the stage one, it's got a massive picture of a Womp on it. Womps being the big stone characters from the Mario series. So I think that is really, really awesome. This company doing the most insane stuff and with a real goal of making life multiplanetary is also basically just throwing Mario characters around there as well. It's brilliant.
We should point out that Mike has a massive man crush on Elon Musk.
Let's just be, yeah.
Clear. Who doesn't, I mean, though, really?
Who doesn't? Yeah. I mean, yeah, everyone in the world should just be behind that guy. And I have made loads and loads of bets with people, like 10 euro bets that SpaceX will get someone to Mars by by the end of the 2020. So if one of our 5,000 listeners wants to make that bet with me as well, I'm happy to do it.
It's basically no risk, isn't it? Because the euro is not going to be around by then.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to say bets with 10-year-olds then, but no.
Do you watch these SpaceX videos with the sound turned down, listening to your scratchy vinyl copy of Pictures at an Exhibition?
When they finally do land people on Mars, I think I'm going to have the Frontier soundtrack playing full blast.
Do you have the same feelings for Elon Musk when we're having issues with PayPal? Is it, oh, well, we can't get this money, but, you know, he's trying to put people on Mars. He's got other priorities.
Thanks, Mike. Anyone else want to have a go?
I suppose I might as well give you my discoveries. They're not very... Well, one of them's a sad discovery, really. No, actually, the other one's quite good. Right, so the sad discovery is that if it's been flooded and if the place where you walk the dog is a floodplain and if the floodplain is covered with human waste and then the dog comes back into your house, you run a greater than average risk of picking up an infection of the tummy digestive tract nature.
Is that,
don't ask me how I know this.
Is that why your complexion is slightly pale today?
Oh, I feel so weak, so weak. I had like some yogurt yesterday. Dear me. The other thing is, it's not really a discovery, but it's kind of a an enlightened, what is the word? I don't even know what the word is. My brain has become so weak now. But I remember years and years ago ripping my David Bowie CDs to OGG format to play on my music player. And every time I put the CD in, it'd open up a web browser and try and take me to something called BowieNet. And I thought this was so annoying because I just wanted to listen to Hunky Dory. But it's only years later that I realise, yeah, it's because he was running an ISP, and that if I'd just been a little bit more alert, I could have been Andrew at BowieNet.com.
It was more than just an ISP, though, wasn't it? He ran... it was like a sort of, you joined it and you got loads of content, and there was chat rooms that he would turn up in and chat with fans and all that sort of thing.
Yeah, but this is like a million years ago. This is before, I think he even had to create the internet in order to do this. Because that's how awesome he was.
He was pretty awesome. That actually links to my finds, if I can carry on. My finds linked to David Bowie's birthday was the 8th of January. And I can't believe I missed this, but the 8th of January 2016.
Ah, yes, I know this.
It's the inception date of Roy Batty. How could I... Well, I suppose there was a lot going on at the time, but I mean, Roy Batty is now among us. So Roy Batty, for anyone who hasn't seen Blade Runner, is the... one of the main characters. I don't want to say bad guy, because he was a slave. But
misunderstood.
Misunderstood. Blade Runner is set in the future, Los Angeles in 2019. So we now have replicants among us that look and behave just like humans. I mean, he's a Nexus 6, so it doesn't really get any better than that. So I imagine he's somewhere in an off-world colony now, so we don't have to worry about it for some time. But, you know, by 2019...
He's watching sea beams glitter in the dark, isn't he?
And my other find, I don't know if we've ever mentioned this before, but it's a tool called BleachBit. I think we have mentioned it. If you go to BleachBit's site, which unfortunately is on SourceForge, which I really can't condone. But there's a quote from Bruce Schneier saying, since he started working with Edward Snowden, he's been using BleachBit. Because BleachBit is a tool for removing all of your caches and temporary files. And there's a Windows version and a Linux version. And I needed to use it this week because I've been having all kinds of performance issues with my main desktop PC, Firefox, and KDE. And for some strange reason, it's... The KWin X11 compositor, the window manager, keeps crashing, and I've had terrible, terrible performance problems with it and with KDE in general, which some people will say is typical for KDE. I basically decided that I needed to remove all my cache files, and BleachBit knows about temporary files and caches and where they're stored and how to remove them really with just a single click, so that you don't remove essential configuration files, so you have basically the same system. It'll get rid of Firefox caches and KD caches and general system temporary files, not only freeing up loads of space, but in my case it totally fixed all of the stability and performance issues I was having, as I imagine KD for whatever reason was grinding through the huge chunk of caches that it had generated for itself. And there's really no downside to it. And it avoids you having to learn about each tool and where it can store its cache files. You can just do it with a certain degree of confidence. It's really excellent. And that's my find.
My first find is that you can use a Google search query to find people that are currently being blackmailed. This is, you may have heard of ransomware. This is basically where some attacker gets into your machine, encrypts all your files, and says, if you have to pay me X amount, otherwise I'll delete the encryption key and you'll never get your files back. Well, they also do this to web servers, and the file that they used to tell you what to do, effectively, is a plain text file called readmeforDecrypt.txt with underscores between readme and where there should be spaces. So if you do an in URL colon readme underscore for underscore decrypt.txt, you get a full list of web servers that have had their files encrypted and ransomed off. And a lot of, in most cases, that file no longer exists. It'll throw a 404 error, which means either they've been able to restore from backup or they've paid the ransom. But in quite a few cases, you'll see that actually the file's still there if you go through it. And there's usually a Bitcoin wallet that you have to pay your money to undecrypt the files, basically. There's a few interesting things about this. One is that it always seems to be one Bitcoin thereafter, no matter the value of Bitcoin. Obviously, it's, you know, and some of them I saw it's $200 and some it was $500 or $400. So they always seem to be after one Bitcoin, not an amount. No idea why. But the other thing is, because Bitcoin wallets are effectively public, you can go to something like blockchain.info, post in the Bitcoin wallet into there and see if they've paid the ransom. And
wow.
Yeah.
That's a really good find.
So you can follow it through in real time. You can sort of wait for these to pop up and then you can find the code, monitor the wallet, see if the money goes in the wallet. And if it does, you can see if they restore the website.
That's quite mind-blowing, really.
Yeah. It's a highway banditry on the web.
Yeah.
Watched in real time. I've no idea if your IP address is going to appear on any lists if you go around looking for readme for decrypt.txt. Don't blame me if men in dark glasses appear at your front door.
Do you think doing it through Tor will help you or make things worse?
I don't know. Take a gamble on how secure Tor is. So that's one of my finds this fortnight. Another is I've started using a pen mouse, which is... Well, it's exactly what it sounds like, really. It's a mouse shaped like a pen. It's kind of like using a graphics tablet type thing, but you can use it on anything because all the gubbins are in the mouse. I'm using it to have issues with RSI, and I'm trying out different things to sort of see how they work. And I found it's not perfect, but when you just need to use the mouse, it works really well. You can just... the sort of feeling of holding a pen is quite comfortable, so you can just move it around and draw.
Is it like a stylus then? Is it?
Well,
right. It does look like a big fat pen.
Yeah, it's a bit bigger than a regular pen. That might just be because I got the cheapest one on Amazon. You might be able to buy fancier ones that are smaller.
Yeah.
It uses a single AA battery and it's quite light. It's not as good when you need to do a lot of clicking, I found.
Yeah.
So if I'm having particular problems, what I've started doing is using my left hand on one mouse for clicking and my right hand on this pen mouse for moving around, and that works really well.
Right.
Another thing that's quite good, it's got a scrolly button on it. So if you're just reading a website, you can just to hold it in your hand and just scroll up and down as you read through a big block of text works quite well. But
can you use it as a stylus as well as a mouse?
I don't know what that means.
I mean, like with like Critter or some application that supports styluses, you could use it for like drawing. I mean, you could probably emulate it with normal mouse actions, but they normally have kind of pressure grades and things like that.
I mean, as far as I'm aware, it just registers as a mouse. So it doesn't, I mean, it's just a laser pointer
right,
in the middle.
Right.
Or a laser mouse.
Oh, I see. So it really is just the function of a laser mouse on the end there.
Yeah. So it won't have any of the pressure stuff and that sort of thing.
Yeah.
So obviously it might be better for drawing. I don't know. I'm not a drawer, just because of the action you can use, but you won't have any extra functionality.
Yeah, yeah.
And those are my finds this fortnight.
Excellent. And they are our finds.
And that brings us hurtling towards the halfway reminder. Still to come, we have some neurons to vocalise and we have some discoveries of... No, we don't. We have some voices of the masses. And we also have a reminder about Beep Beep Yar, which is our excellent new book, which we're going to unleash on the world today, this very day. Beepbeepyar.com will take you to the Kickstarter page. And that's Yar with two R's.
And just to add to what we talked about earlier about that, alongside the book, sort of in addition, you get some interactive elements, so that when you read some of the adventure story and you pick up some of the ideas of computing, you can go on there, and it's not programming, but it's sort of puzzles that you solve that sort of help cement the ideas of programming. So as you solve the puzzles, you pick up the ideas of conditions and loops, even though you don't really know you're picking up the ideas of conditions and loops.
Yeah.
If you sit a 7-year-old down and say, today we're going to learn about loops, you know, good luck, you're not going to get very far.
Well, no, I mean, the idea that we had, and we had this like ages ago, we've been meaning to do this for ages, was really to kind of create a brilliant, exciting story that kind of inadvertently taught kids a little bit about how to program on computers, so that they, you know, they can basically have fun.
Yeah, so it's basically a book and computer game that when you do them, they are both fun to do and entertaining things. You just so happen to have learned about computing on the way.
Awesome. So let's have this episode's neuron that was sent in from Matt, who didn't provide a surname, or maybe he just doesn't have one. But Matt says, I have recently switched to using Vim after hearing about it in your podcast and have been amazed how much it can do. I now use it for most times when I need to edit text files, and I love it. It's a great example of the power of open source software. If you can't do it with Vim, then you probably can't do it at all, as far as text files are concerned at least. More recently, I have started using the i3 window manager, also after hearing you mention it in the podcast. Although I have only been using it for a few weeks, I'm impressed by how fast you can pick it up, and I do not want to go back to the dark ages of stacking window managers. Thanks for the great podcast and magazine. Thank you, Matt. I think that combination of i3WM and Vim is becoming increasingly popular, especially when you look at like screenshots people put up on the net.
Mike's really smiling. You should see him.
I don't actually use i3, but that's because I'm using a laptop keyboard. At some point, I want to buy one of those nice ergonomic keyboards, and then I think I can really just get rid of the mouse forever and just switch to fully tiling and Vim text editing. But they are an awesome combo. So yeah, cheers, Matt. If anybody else wants their neurons vocalized, email them to me, mike@linuxvoice.com.
So that brings us on to Voice of the Masses. Now, we only put this up yesterday, so it's a very short Voice of the Masses. The question being, well, actually, let's have some... It's a really long question. It's almost as if we didn't design the question with the podcast in mind. So the question really is, should the Linux Foundation have community representation? Now, this is because the Linux Foundation has recently changed its rules. Is this correct?
That's right.
About individual members. So if you're a human being, Joe Bloggs, you can join the Linux Foundation. Well, you used to be able to join the Linux Foundation and also vote on its leadership and other things, corporate governance.
You used to be able to vote, nominate a person to be on the board as the representative of the community.
Right. And this position has now been taken away, is that right?
That's right. On the eve of Karen Sandler putting herself forward as one of the prospective members. And so Karen Sandler, she works with the Software Conservancy, and the Software Freedom Conservancy are currently sponsoring a legal challenge to VMware. This is being played out in courts, but basically they're saying that VMware isn't fulfilling the obligations of the GPL and releasing its own modifications to the kernel that it uses in some of its virtualization stuff. It's a long legal case. It's ongoing. I think it comes to court this year. So the cynics would say that this move has blocked Karen Sandler being elected to a board that also has VMware on the board. So VMware is a corporate sponsor of the Linux Foundation.
Because all healthy organisations need everyone to agree all the time.
Well, I mean, I suppose to dive into this, Jim Zemlin, the guy in charge, basically, of the Linux Foundation, said that Karen's a wonderful person. This was a coincidental that that they'd been talking about making this move for a long time, and the fact that they did it at a time when Cameron was putting herself forward is a coincidence. Really nothing to do with whatever the issues might have been brought up or whatever complexities might have been introduced by Cameron being some representative of the Software Freedom Conservancy. That's what his statement on the matter. But the matter as it stands, and as it stands, the Linux Foundation, which owns the Linux, which manages the Linux trademark, owns the Linux.com domain name and employs Linus Torvalds, has no representatives from the community other than from a nomination from the kernel developers. And I think so the CEO of Sugar CRM and B. Dale Garby. Everything else, as is right, actually, for a foundation that is...
It's a trade association.
A trade association is made up from the people that pay for its various tiers of membership, the platinum and gold and silver tiers or whatever.
So, should a trade organization have community representation? I think the clue's in the question there. Moira.
But it's not, you see, it owns Linux.com, it employs Linus Torvalds. It's what people outside of knowing whether it's a trade organization or not will assume is some kind of the Microsoft or the Apple of the entire project that is Linux.
There are two really schools of thought to this. So Moylan says, a Linux organization that doesn't have representation from non-profits, users slash developers is never going to represent the best interests of the Linux community. Polyamorous Penguin says, is it me or am I the only one to think that the Linux Foundation's tongue is forked more than the OS that they profess to protect and promote? Or the other view is that actually, being a trade organisation, the Linux Foundation has no real obligation to have community involvement. Omniferous Implementer says, does it really care about the community? Its funding comes from the companies it represents. It promotes Linux only for these to increase their profits by increased usage of their Linux-based products, a necessary evil for the Linux ecosystem, even if we don't like it. That's from linuxvoice.com. That's from our own thread, our discussion. Over on Reddit, which seems to be full of libertarian types, Pizzaiolo says, more important question, should the Linux Foundation have corporate representation? Apparently, it's the literal point of the Linux Foundation is to represent business, its business interests, the business interests of its members. So, you know, it has no real business doing anything else. Best expressed by a tsunami of Rod, who says, this last week is like finding out that the Linux Foundation is basically a bunch of corporations getting together to decide how to make Linux best serve corporate interests. In 1 year, we will come to the shocking realization that every program ever written by Red Hat and Canonical serves a financial goal. Seems a bit cynical, maybe.
I think personally, my issue isn't that there is a trade organization for companies that use Linux to help progress it. It's a combination of the amount of power that trade organization has and the fact that it pretends not to be a trade organization. And if you look at its sort of mission statement, it's all about promoting ecosystems and blah, de, blah, de, blah.
Yeah.
And being wonderful for the community. It's created this aura for itself where, you know, it employs a lot of kernel developers. It's got a huge influence in the direction the Linux kernel takes. Yet, it actually only represents a tiny fraction of the people who use Linux.
Mm.
And it's, from my view, it's that question, not whether or not it should allow community representation, more about whether or not it should be honest about what it really does and whether or not it should have as much power as it does.
I agree, and I actually feel quite strongly about it, and I have done for quite some time. I think the Linux Foundation assumes this position, at least, and that it doesn't make clear itself that it is a trade organization. It kind of puts itself as the pinnacle of what Linux as a project is about, and Linux as a project is not representative of the Linux Foundation's membership. I don't have a problem. They actually have a legal obligation as a trade organization to look after the interests of its members. But I also have another problem with things like they do their own certification. And yet I feel that the Linux Foundation should be promoting other businesses to create their own certification, people like the LPI. And they're unfairly using their kind of monopoly in their position as the Linux.com to basically make it less viable to run a business in Linux in certain cases. And I have a problem with that as well. The Linux project itself is a success because of the community, and for that not to be reflected even in a corporate way at the Linux Foundation, I think is disappointing.
It seems a bit ham-fisted as well. I mean, you can. There's no shortage of people claiming to be free software advocates. Community is such a wishy-washy term. You can install a puppet king and just have them do and say what you want them to say, and just say at the same time, look, here's our community leader. How dare you say that we don't represent the interests of the community? Here is, Well, I'm just trying to think of some of the names from Bernard Cornwell's excellent The Last Kingdom, in which there are Anglo-Saxon puppet kings on the throne, but they dance to the Vikings tune. You could do that so easily. Not with Karen, though, because she is smarter than the average Anglo-Saxon. But there are so many people who just want to feel that they are the voice of something, and you could pluck any one of those. And just install them and say, oh, look, there we go, community. Great, hooray for community.
Which is exactly why you should allow the individual members to vote a board director.
Yeah, I don't see the problem with it. There's a majority of other board members anyway. The corporate interests are well reflected on the board. I mean, it's not going to be very attractive for individual membership, but perhaps individual members don't count for much when it costs an awful lot of money to become a platinum sponsor of the Linux Foundation.
Yeah, it's around $500,000 to be a platinum sponsor, and at the lowest level it's still a few thousand for a silver sponsor. And the platinum sponsors vote in the majority of the board, and there's eight of them, and they pretty much control it.
Oh yeah.
So the platinum members are Fujitsu, HP, Huawei,
yeah.
I don't know how you pronounce that, IBM, Intel, NEC, Oracle, Qualcomm and Samsung. Actually, I thought Google were platinum as well.
Yeah.
Apparently not.
Google are gold.
Right. Yeah.
Poor Google. Poor skint Google.
Yeah, so it's in a similar way to, I mean, similar but related, the fact that opensource.com is owned and run by Red Hat.
I thought opensource.com would have been the open source initiative, or is that something else?
Well, they probably couldn't afford the domain. Yeah, so I feel that the Linux Foundation should either make it much clearer that it represents corporate interests, and that includes kind of shifting its emphasis from its main website and all that kind of stuff, or it should accept more community oversight.
You know what this is crying out for? Four pages in Linux Voice about what the Linux Foundation is, what it does.
That's a good idea, yeah.
This is what it purports to be.
Yeah. The other thing is that, I mean, in the past, we've tried to talk to at Linux Voice and before as well, for years, tried to speak to Jim Zemlin, even when we've been in the same location as Jim Zemlin. And he's a very difficult person to talk to. And I get the impression that they're just not interested. So in terms of furthering whatever we as the community wants, the Linux Foundation isn't the organization to do it.
And potentially this all started because they're trying to protect one of their members from a lawsuit for violating the GPL. I mean, that's not just not being in the interest of the community, that's not being in the interests of Linux.
Yes, that's right. It's the Linux Foundation wouldn't exist were, you know, the GPL not the license used for the kernel.
And if you look at other members, people like Oracle have got a pretty shady relationship with open source, are they? Not necessarily outright violations. And
Yeah. Bradley Kuhn actually speaks a little about this in the interview that we ran in with him last issue.
He's from the Software Conservancy, isn't he?
That's right,
yes. The organisation that defends the GPL.
That's right, and the organisation that Karen is a member of. And it's them that are sponsoring. I can't remember the developer, unfortunately. I think it's in Germany, Mike. The name of the kernel developer who's challenging VMware.
Oh, Christoph Helwig, I think.
Yes.
Yeah,
that's right.
It's a very, you know, I suppose we've talking about this too long. It's a very small but important point. And it really marks kind of maybe a turning point between the use of the GPL and more permissive licenses that we've talked about before. But if VMware is using GPL code, it has an obligation, just like everybody does. And that's it's that obligation that has made Linux such a great success. So it's something to embrace.
Let's leave it there with embracing success. Let's leave this potentially negative, evil people piggybacking off of others' hard work, trying to monopolize it and charge rent on it into something actually quite lovely. And with that thought, beepbpr.com.
I actually have one more thing, which is perhaps a good thing to finish on. Briefly, a couple of months ago, we had a fantastic competition we ran with our friends Pimeroni, where we gave away loads of their stuff. If people just found a load of penguins in the magazine, you might remember that there were many more than the 10 penguins we asked for. I think 27 is the record. But I compiled a list of all the people that entered to win one of three different batches of kit, including PiBo, PiCage, Raspberry Pi 2s, lots of brilliant stuff to play with. While there's too many to do it live, we thought we'd pick out five winners of the best kit live at the end of this podcast. So we'll
hang on. Can't we just say that no one got it correct and keep the stuff ourselves?
Winner number one is Ben Everard.
Woo!
These five people that we're going to choose now have won a Raspberry Pi, a PiBo Coupe case, and the PiCade, which includes the 8-inch screen. So that's a fantastic little thing you can put on your desktop and play retro video games on. So I've created this randomized list of email addresses, and Mike's going to choose a random number on his machine and tell me the number of somebody in this list, and I'll find the person from my Vim file.
So tell me when you're ready, Graham.
Okay, I'm ready.
Okay, here we go. The wheel is spinning, and the result is 83.
83. Right, that is... Okay, just let me search the email address.
Is it a dev/random or a dev/you random wheel you've got, Mike?
I'm using random.org website, which says it offers true random numbers to anyone on the internet. It comes from Atmospheric Noise. So I think that's pretty random.
No, they are really random.
Okay, well, so the first one goes to Fred Flynn in Canada, in Toronto, Canada.
Awesome.
Well done, Fred.
Yeah.
Well done, Fred. Fred. All right.
Go for another one.
Let's spin again. Here we go. And the result is 133.
133. Okay. Well, this looks like a US email address. And that one goes to... Oh, no, I'm mistaken. It's Peter Cave in Coventry.
I'm intrigued. What does a US email address
look like? It was .us. I don't want to read the whole thing out, but...
Okay. It wasn't like Chad at freedom.us.
DonaldTrump.us.
Okay.
Okay.
Should we do the other thing?
Another spin. Here we go. Number three. We're spinning up here. The wheel is spinning. And the result is 189.
189. Okay. This is a .NET address. Just let me search. That is Peter Maunder from Cirencester, just up the road. Well done, Peter.
Wunderbar. Okay, number four.
Four.
Spin the wheel again.
This is like bingo.
It is. It's very intense. And it's 77. What is 77 in bingo? Like, no, I don't know.
Does it go up that high?
No, maybe not.
88, okay, 77. That late, isn't it? So yeah. It must go up to 77, unless it just skips numbers.
This is interesting. It was from a .org address. It's Aaron Gourlay at Corby Technical School in Corby, North Hants. So that's good.
Apparently it's double hockey stick 77.
Double hockey stick.
So you guys were on those kits? And the last one of these five. We've got another 10 to give away, but don't want to try everybody's patience.
Yeah, let's spin the wheel for the last one. And it's spinning, and the result is 117.
There's no bingo thing for that.
Well, legs 11.
This is a Spanish
times 10 plus 7.
This is a Spanish email address. Okay. This is Jose Gonzalez Oliva from Barcelona.
Congratulations.
Awesome. Congratulations to all of those people. Enjoy your piecades. And thanks to Pimeroni too.
Great.
So that's the end of the podcast. Thanks, everyone.
Yeah, thanks, Pimeroni.
Oh, I created a little bit of music for the Beep Beep Yar video. It's loosely based on the music to Neverending Story.
Awesome.
You can see it on the Kickstarter page. I'll put it on YouTube. But I thought I'd finish off this with a kind of an advert, really, with the audio from the video. But it's the best, it's a good description of what the book's about and what we're trying to do. So, bye.
Bye, everybody.
Bye. Bye.
See you soon.
My name's Graham Morrison. I'm the editor of a computer magazine called Linux Voice, a magazine that's completely independent, put together by just five of us that we actually crowdfunded just a couple of years ago. But I'm not here to talk about Linux Voice. I'm here because me and the team would like to try something new, something we're really excited about. And I think the best person to introduce this idea is my 8-year-old daughter, Eden.
This is Grace and this is Alan. Grace and Alan are just like my best friends. They love to learn. They like to push themselves and do cool things. And they aren't afraid to try anything new.
We want to create a children's book we're calling Beep Beep Yar. A children's book to help kids discover the world of computers. A book about Grace and Alan and their robot, Tinker. Like any good robot, Tinker is controlled by a computer. He can't think for himself, but Grace and Alan, with our help, can tell him exactly what to do and how to do it. He's limited only by their imagination, which pretty much means he can do anything. We want our book to tell the story of Grace, Alan, and Tinker, whilst at the same time introducing some simple, fundamental concepts to how computers work. We want our story to inspire kids to learn about code. And while we're not going to put code into the story itself, we're going to use the story to introduce many of the ideas you actually use while programming. Things like logic and conditions, flow control, and breaking complicated problems down into smaller parts. And to do this effectively, we're going to take those ideas out of the book and augment each chapter with an interactive element that you and your children can both use online, on a laptop, on a smartphone, on a tablet, to put some of those ideas into practice. We want to create an awesome adventure storybook that introduces some of the concepts behind programming and combine this with an interactive website where those ideas can be put into practice.
A mixture of learning and adventure, programming with a story.
We can get Beep Beep Yar into your hands by the end of July, which in the UK is just in time for the school holidays, a time when you and your children can read together and play with computers together and discover programming together. Whether it's for your children, your niece or nephews, other children you know, please consider backing Beep Beep Yar. And together, I think we'll all create something awesome.